Parsha of Vayetze begins with Yaakov's famous dream. As the Pasuk describes it in Perek Kapches, Pasuk Yedbeis, Vayachalom, so Yaakov's on the run, and he arrives at the place, Vayavga b'makom, Mokom HaMikdash, or wherever it is, and he lays down to sleep, and has his famous dream, Pasuk Yedbeis, Vayachalom, dreams, Vihine, Sulam Mutzav Arza, V'rosho Magia HaShamayma. So there's the ladder. It's stationed on the ground, rooted in the ground, but its head reaches heavenwards. V'hine malachei elokim olim v'yordim bo. And there are malachim going up and down. And that's Pasuk Yud Beis. And then Yud Gimel has the final component of the dream, which is Hashem himself. Pasuk Yud Gimel, v'hine Hashem nitzav alav. Hashem is standing over him and gives him his message. Now this dream is not the only dream in the Torah. There are a number of dreams. They're all in Chumash Bereishis. But it is the only dream in the Torah which doesn't have its interpretation alongside it. When you think about it, all the other dreams that we know of, the Sara Mashkim and the Sara Ofim, Yosef interprets them. Yosef's own dreams are interpreted by the brothers, his father. Paro's dreams are interpreted by Yosef. Yet here, we have this dream, and that's all we have is the presentation without interpretation, which of course leaves it open now to everyone since to speak in interpretation of this dream. And that begins from Chazal themselves and onwards. And it's a very interesting, before we get to Rashi, which I think is the better known explanation, it's a very interesting approach, which is to be found in the Sefer Akedas Yitzchak. The Akedas Yitzchak, Rabbeinu Yitzchak HaRama. And he explains as follows. And he sets out to discuss what are these Malachei Elokim that are rising and falling? What is the relationship between what they represent and Hashem who is Nitzav Alav? So the truth is, says Akedas Yitzchak, perhaps in Yaakov more than any of the Avos, we see something of opposites in the way that he began his life to the way it then transitions. For most of his time, or for his younger years, he's Yoshev Aholim, as the Pasuk describes him. Rashi explains, Ahalo Shel Shem, Ahalo Shel Eber, as we spoke about, he's learning. And in fact, even when he runs away from Esav, Chazal tell us in the Gemara Megillah, he spends the first 14 years also learning. That's how you run away. It's 14 years of learning and then you're ready. Where is Yeshiva Shem Ve'Evre? It can't be far away from where Yitzchak lived in his youth. That's where he learned. Amazingly, Esav didn't think to look there. And he hasn't gotten over it, as we see from the beginning of next week's Parsha. But Yaakov feels that he can station himself for a number of years in the Yeshiva of Eiver, actually, as we mentioned last week, and he's safe from Esav either way. In this week's Parsha, we see Yaakov involved in very different things. He's no longer not in the Yeshiva of Eiver, and not in the Yeshiva of anyone. He's working as a shepherd for Lavan for a number of years, Esrim Shana, the 20 years of looking after the sheep of Lavan and for all the various arrangements. And it's quite a contrast from younger Yaakov to older Yaakov. Yaakov in learning, Yaakov in shepherding. And as we mentioned in the past, this really represents Yaakov needing to take on another role that perhaps he may not have had. And it's a very striking idea that Esav could have been part of the future of the Jewish people together with Yaakov, partnering somehow, taking care of the more temporal things while Yaakov deals with more spiritual matters. Once Esav abdicates from that role, which he did from a very early age and shows no interest whatsoever, if anything, the opposite, So then it falls to Yaakov now to take on both roles. And in fact, as we mentioned in the past, this is a part of what's behind Yaakov marrying both Leah and Rachel. Rashi will inform us, and it's from Chazal in the Medrash, that there was this Mesorah that people had. There was the Shmua that Lavan has two daughters, and Yitzhak has two sons, and the older should be for the older, and the younger for the younger. So Leah literally cries her eyes out that that shouldn't happen, and we know a bit about Esav, who can blame her? And in the end, she doesn't marry Esav. But the question is, why should she have married Esav in the first place? What did she ever do wrong that she should be? I mean, the fact that she was born first and he's born first, it sounds like it was something that was taken very seriously. It wasn't just shidduch rumors or the like. And Mefarshim explain that actually Leah, as the designated one for Esav, wasn't a sign of her doing anything wrong. It was actually what would have happened if Esav would have done everything right. In other words, the two sisters and the two brothers together would have been the two couples to continue. But once Esav bails from the program, so now Leah is still part of the future of the Jewish people. But Yaakov, having taken over both roles now, the role of Yaakov, his pure role, his initial role, plus the additional role of Esav, so he then now marries Rachel for Yaakov and Leah for the Esav part of things. And so Yaakov now broadens out to be involved not only in spiritual pursuits, but also in material pursuits. And the question is, what does that say about Yaakov? Is that a step down for Yaakov? Is it somehow a shortcoming? And this, says the Akedas Yitzchak, is what's happening in the dream. Because you have Malachei Elokim, you have these spiritual forces, these spiritual concepts. And Olim V'Yardimbo, they go up and they go down, meaning Yaakov has had his time when the Malachim are in ascent, but also when they seem to be in descent. In other words, when he's involved in Malach type of things, Olim. But he's about to be involved in not angelic things, seemingly more earthly and temporal things. So the Malachim are Yordim. So how does this all fit together? But the answer, says the Akedas Yitzchak, is in the next pasuk. V'hineh Hashem nitzav alav. Hashem is standing over him. And what that means is the cohesion and the inclusion and the harmonization of these two aspects of Yaakov, both the Olim and the Yardim, both involved in the spiritual and involved in the more physical, they're both part of the same ladder and they're both part of the same person, because Hashem stands over him. That is to say, Hashem hovers over all of it, and regardless of the area that he's involved in, it's all done in pursuit of Hashem's goals and values and purposes, and therefore Hashem Nitzav Alav is what brings the Olim and the Yordim together within Yaakov, giving him these two elements. So that's a very interesting explanation of the Mare Hasulam, of this Chalom from the Akedas Yitzchak. As we know, Rashi says that these Malachim were actually two sets of Malachim, and in fact Rashi begins, as he doesn't always do, rarely I think in fact, by raising a question in the pasuk, which he then comes to answer. I think normally Rashi just gets to his explanation, leaving Mefarshei Rashi to fathom or to work out what it was that Rashi was bothered by in the pasuk. But here, Rashi doesn't leave us in any suspense, or he doesn't leave us in the dark. He says explicitly, Olim V'Yardim. The pasuk itself seems quite straightforward. They're going up and down. Not much to say, but Rashi says there is, because it mentions Olim before Yardim, going up before going down. Well, the klal in life, what goes up must come down. That's true for almost everything, except for Malachim. Because if they start in the higher realms, it's much more correct to say what goes down must come up. How can they be Olim v'Yordim, says Rashi, Olim Tchila, first going up, v'chakach Yordim. It's very interesting, and perhaps Rashi makes a point of telling us that he's bothered by this. It could be that one may have passed by it. And indeed, worth noting, again, as we have in the past, that Rashi's own grandson, the famous Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, in his Perush on the Torah, comments on the words Olim v'Yordim, and his comment is, Lefi ha-pshat, ein ledaktik. On a pshat level, there's no need to be particular. It mentions going up before going down. Says Rashbam, that's you get the message. If you're yekish, and you say, well, surely you go down and then you go up. Says Rashbam, well, you can say that if you want, but if you're looking for the pshat and if you're not looking for trouble, this isn't cause for trouble. So this is very interesting, because both Rashi and Rashbam have their stated goal to resolve pshat issues in the pasuk, but here their machlokas is not what is the pshat, but what even needs to be addressed on a pshat level. No one is more aware of Rashi's commentary on the Torah than his grandson, the Rashbam. He comes into this pasuk knowing that Rashi has made an issue out of this, has seen this as a difficulty. First Olim, and then Yardim, and Rashbam doesn't even talk about Rashi. It's all subtext. Rashbam says, Lefi ha-pshat ein ledaktik, if it says up and down, that's not, I wouldn't make an issue out of it, even though Rashi had. What then is the resolution of all of this? Malachim, says Rashi, Shenivahu ba'aretz. It's what we would call the changing of the guard, where the Malachim who accompanied him in Eretz Yisrael, Ein Yotzin Chutz La'aretz, they can't leave. So they're the Olim. So the first group is Olim, the ones that have accompanied him until now. And then the next group is Yardim. V'yardim alachei chutz la'aretz l'lavoso. So that is the situation with regards to Olim v'yardim. And then Rashi also comments on the next pasuk, Yud Gimel, v'inei Hashem nitzavalav. Hashem is standing over him. And Rashi gives one word of explanation, L'shomro, to protect him. And this is very interesting, because I don't think anyone was more protected than Yaakov. He's got troops of malachim, this one and that one. And but nonetheless, Rashi says, Hashem is standing over him to look after him. But why does he need guarding? Why does he need protecting with all these malachim? So a very interesting answer to this question is to be found in the Sefer Pardes Yosef, one of these encyclopedic, one person who was able to put all this together. The Sefer Pardes Yosef, published just before the war. In fact, Vayikra was published in 1939. And that's as far as he got. He was killed in the Shoah. And he begins by addressing another question. On Friday night, so we also address Malachim. Right, for once a week, we say, Shalom Aleichem, Malachi Asharis, we welcome in the Malachim. And what's the background to this? The background is, as the Gemara says in Maseches Shabbos, that there are two Malachim that accompany a person home on Friday night, and it's those Malachim that are being welcomed in. I might mention, it's very interesting to get an insight. You know, we sometimes think that 100 years ago or 200 years ago, everyone must have been as frum as can be. In the town of someone, you know, of the great Gedolim, we can't imagine that there was anyone who was not like that, not towing the line. It's not always the case. And even in the famous Posen, the town Posen of Rabbi Kiva Eger in the 1800s, he became aware that there were certain people who came to shul on Friday night. But then after that, they would go to the theater or the opera or whatever it was. It doesn't sound right to us, but that's how it was. It's not right. Of course, tickets were prepaid before Shabbos, and it was all worked out according to there shouldn't be any muktzahs and there shouldn't be anything, but the lamaisa, they made their way from shul to the theater, and it fell upon Rabbi Kiva Eger to address this issue. And that really is the chiddush, because we would think that Rabbi Kiva Eger only needs to deal with Tosfos, but he also needed to deal with theater goers on Friday night. But what to do? What are you going to say? Halachically, they've sorted themselves out already. They may have been not exactly up to par, but the lomdus they've taken care of. So Rabbi Kiva Eger, he gets up in shul on Friday night. And he says, it's come to my attention that there is something quite objectionable going on in our community. And that is that people are in violation of theft, of gezel. Of course, no one is expecting that. No one was stealing, as far as anyone knew, in a community-wide problem. So Rabbi Akiva Egressel will explain what I mean. I've heard that there are people who, when they go from shul, they go to the theater. And they've worked it all out. And it's all prepaid. There's just one problem. The Gemara says, when you leave shul on Friday night, you're accompanied by two malachim. And wherever you go, they go. So basically, they're getting an admission of three for the price of one. They should pay for the malachim also. And this was his way of indicating that that's not the way to go about things. So either way, so we say shalom aleichem, but it's very interesting, and it's easy not to pay attention to this. There's four stanzas in shalom aleichem, and it's very rapid. Shalom aleichem, so far so good. Baruch Hu shalom, even better. Baruchuni l'shalom, very nice. And then seischem l'shalom. Time to go. I mean, that's, you know, for their troubles, they get a very quick dispatch. They came, they blessed, and they were sent away. Why does it happen so quickly? But many Meforshim say that the malachim that we say seischem l'shalom to are not the same as the ones that we say boachem l'shalom. A person is always accompanied by malachim. But there are special malachim for Shabbos. So what we do is first we welcome in the Shabbos malachim, boachem l'shalom, and once they're there, we then say seischem l'shalom to the weekday malachim, who can now go because they've been relieved by the new watch of Shabbos malachim. Now, the question is, why does it happen that way? Why do we first welcome in the Shabbos malachim? And then only then say goodbye to the weekday malachim. The answer is because you don't want to be without malachim. Better they should overlap than for you to be left in between. So you don't want to say goodbye to the first set before you've received the second set. And that's why first we say bochem l'shalom, so we're covered. Only after the new malachim have arrived, then the regular malachim can be sent away. Well, if that's the case, so then, says the Pardes Yosef, let's go back to Parshas Vayetze, and we'll see an interesting thing. Namely, Rashi told us, Malachei Elokim, and it's very bedikduk, Malachei Elokim, Olim v'yordim bo, go up and go down. The Malachim of Eretz Yisrael go up, and seemingly before the Malachim of Chutz La'aretz come down. That leaves Yaakov momentarily with no Malachim. Because the ones that were with him have left, and the ones that are to arrive have not yet arrived for that moment. And it's regarding that moment, says the Pardes Yosef, that Rashi says, V'hineh Hashem nitzav alav l'shomro. He needs a shmira of Hashem when he's without malachim for that moment. The question, of course, is, why didn't he do it like shalom aleichem? In other words, why not first receive the new malachim before relinquishing the existing malachim of Eretz Yisrael? And this question is addressed by the Maskil of David. And the Maskil of David says that there is a hierarchy among the malachim. They're not all of the same level or stature. Specifically, as we can appreciate, it's no surprise, the malachim of Eretz Yisrael are on a higher madrega than the malachim of Chutz La'aretz. Eretz Yisrael itself is on a higher level. It's Malachim on a higher level. So the more subordinate Malachim, the junior Malachim of Chutz La'aretz are not allowed to display jurisdiction or authority within the presence of their seniors. And therefore they can't come to take care of Yaakov as long as the higher malachim of Eretz Yisrael are there. That's why the malachim of Eretz Yisrael need to leave, and then without any malachim, those of Chutz La'aretz, because that's better than nothing, But they can't come and begin to impose their authority in the presence of Malachim of Eretz Yisrael. It's very interesting. And in fact, as a Maskilat David, we can see that this is the case, because this is not the only time in our Parsha where we will see these two groups interplaying. It happens at the beginning of Vayetze, when he leaves, but it also happens at the end of Vayetze, when Yaakov comes back. How so? Because the final psukim, it says, Yaakov halach ledarko, he's finished with Lavan, and he's finally on his way back, Vayifgu bo malachei Elokim, and then he's met by a camp of malachim. And who are these malachim? Says Rashi, it's the malachim of Eretz Yisrael. They've been waiting for 20 years, and now they're back again to be with him, because he's on his way back to Eretz Yisrael. And the final pasuk says, Vayoma Yaakov kashera am. Yaakov says, when he sees them, Machane Elokim zeh, this is a camp of God, camp of Malachim, Vayikra eshem hamakom ahu, and what does he call the place? Machanayim, two camps. Why two camps? Says Rashi, because you have two camps of Malachim. Malachim of Eretz Yisrael and Malachim of Chutz Laaretz. So what's very interesting is, when we see the process reversed, we see that the Malachim of Eretz Yisrael do come before those of Chutz Laaretz are sent away. There's a point, there's a moment of overlap. Machanayim, the two are together. Why? Because the issue with the Malachim of Chutz Laaretz taking over in the presence of Malachim of Eretz Yisrael, so that can't happen on the way out. But on the way back, Malachim of Eretz Yisrael can take over while Malachim of Chutz Laaretz are still there. And therefore you see the precision as you transition from Eretz Yisrael to Chutz Laaretz. On the way out, Eretz Yisrael needs to leave before Chutz Laaretz comes. On the way back, they can overlap. Eretz Yisrael can come. And it occurred to me, and I'm not sure if anyone says this, but presumably the same is true. The relationship of Malachim of Eretz Yisrael to Chutz Laaretz and vice versa is the same as the Malachim of Shabbos to weekday, in the same way that the Malachim of Eretz Yisrael are on a higher level, Malachim of Shabbos are on a higher level. And that is why, when we say Shalom Aleichem, we can welcome in the Malachim of Shabbos, because again, if they're on a higher level, they can come even while Malachim of the weekday are still there, and then we can say goodbye to them. First Shalom Aleichem to the new, and then Tzeiskrim L'Shalom. But if that's true, and if we just seek to fill in the final box within this square, then what about Motzei Shabbos, when they change again? So at this point, the Malachim of Shabbos go, and Malachim of Chol come back, but as per what we've learned from Rashi, they can't overlap, because the Malachim of Chol are like the Malachim of Chul, Malachim of Chutz Laaretz. So they can't go until the Malachim of Shabbos have gone, which is interesting. And I wonder, and it'd be interesting to see if anyone speaks in this way, the first thing we say as we're about to make the transition within the course of Havdalah is the pasuk, Hine kel yeshuasi eftach b'lo efchan. Hashem is my salvation. I trust in him. I won't be afraid. And the question is, what are you afraid of? I mean, some people are afraid. Who knows what's waiting for them if they switch on their computer and they've had one day of peace. But why would you be afraid? But I think according to this, we can understand. For exactly the same reason why Yaakov needed Hashem to save him in that interim moment where there were no Malachim, because Eretz Yisrael had gone before Chutz Laaretz arrived, so too the Malachim of Shabbos need to go before the Malachim of Chutz Laaretz come back. And that happens when you make Havdalah. And therefore, for that moment, we say, Hine kel yeshuasi eftach b'lo efchan, like Hine Hashem nitzav alav, l'shomro. So this is perhaps some insight into that opening of Havdalah. Otherwise, it seemed like a rather unusual thing to say. All you're doing is making Havdalah. So these are some comments with regards to the well-known Rashi, Malachei Elokim, Olim V'yordim Bo. Now, when Yaakov wakes up, and of course this was literally a revelation for Yaakov, he realizes where he was, he realizes now the sanctity of the place. He says in Pasuk Tet Zayin, Vayikatz Yaakov Mishnoso, he wakes up from his sleep, Vayomer, Achein Yesh Hashem, indeed, Hashem is here, B'makom Hazeh, V'anuchel Yodati, in other words, the divine presence is here in such a concentrated form. And then, in Pasuk Yud Ches, it says, Vayashkem Yaakov Baboker. So Yaakov reacts to his relationship with that place at two stages. Firstly, instantly, upon having the dream, he wakes up and exclaims what he exclaims. And then the next thing we see is in the morning, where there's more to be done. Vayashkem Yaakov Baboker. There's an ongoing question as to whether the word Vayashkem necessarily means that he was asleep. Vayashkem, in other words, Hashkama means to get to arise early. Does that mean to arise from a state of sleep? Or simply to begin to be active in the morning? If it's the former, that means that Yaakov had this revelation, made his exclamation, but then went back to sleep, and then woke up again in the morning. But that's a question that's debated by Mefarshim, all the Vayashkems. Because when Avram did the Akedah, it also says Vayashkem Avram Baboke, which means he went to sleep in the night before the Akedah. One would have thought if ever there was a sleepless night, it's going to be the night before the Akedah. So, and therefore the connotation of the word Vayashkem is discussed in many settings. Either way, Vayashkem Yaakov Baboke, Pasuk Yud Ches, he took the Evan, we know from Rashi, originally a number of stones, then became one stone. And he made it into a form of, well, what the Torah calls a matseva is a type of mizbeach. It was one stone. In the time of the Avos, it was used a lot. It subsequently becomes forbidden by the Torah because it was taken over by Avodah Zarah, which itself is very interesting. We see that the Avos will use the matseva in this sense, this one rock, and that's the mizbeach. But then later on, the Torah forbids it. Lo takim lecha matseva. You cannot have matseva. Asher sonei Hashem elokecha. Hashem hates it. Says Chazal. It was ahuva bimeha avos. It was beloved in the time of the avos, but it became hated by being used for avodah zarah. Which is interesting because that shows that the concept of the impact of something being an idolatrous practice can sometimes even take hold if prior to that it was a good practice. In other words, when the Avos did it, it was fine, and they did it before the Avodah Zarah did it. And still, it assumed the dimensions of Chukas Hagoy, or whatever you call it. That's a very interesting concept, that sometimes Chukas Hagoy can come second and then undo something which otherwise would have been acceptable and even positive. And that's the basis of the very famous position of the Vilna Gaon with regards to trees on Shavuos, where originally the Magen Avraham says that the minhag is to have trees. I mean, that would take some doing. We have our hands full with flowers and greenery. But to actually put trees in the shul, because Shavuos is the Yom HaDin for Heiros HaIlam. So they would actually put trees in shul, says the Vilna Gaon. You can't do that anymore. A festive tree is not a Jewish thing anymore. It's very goyish. It's chukas hagoy. But some people raise the objection from the Vilna Gaon. Well, we came first. In other words, the positive value has got nothing to do with chukas hagoy. It then became a Christian thing to have a tree, etc. But why should that affect us? But one of the sources is the concept of matzeva, whereby it was also a Jewish thing initially, but it became un-Jewish, objectionably so. In any case, it's very interesting to see how these episodes and events become part of that discussion. Either way, he takes the stones, matzeva, v'yitzok shemen arosha, and he pours oil on the top. What's the point of pouring oil? What is that? Maybe it's a form of almost like a korban, like a nesech. I don't think we ever find a korban of oil per se. We find wine by itself, nesachim, water even on sukkahs. Oil is for sure used within the context of korbanos, but it could be that this was some type of korban. In any case, the question is, why does Yaakov do this, as leaving all practicalities aside, why does Yaakov do this the next morning specifically, and not when he first becomes appraised of the exalted and special status of the place? And the Meshech Chochma gives an answer which is eye-opening. Actually, we find in Chazal that, and as we know, a theme that runs through Chumash Bereishis is that of Ma'aseh Avos Siman Abonim. what the others do. That's a sign for the for their descendants. What that means is everything that is experienced nationally by the Jewish people has been pre-experienced personally by the others. We see it with regards to Avram going down to Mitzrayim. That's a Maisa Avos for our whole Mitzrayim experience. Ramban discusses at length in last week's Parsha, where there's a lot of attention given to Yitzchak digging his wells, the first well, the second well, the third well. All of these are Maisa Avos for the three Batei Mikdash. And so too, says the Sifrei in Devarim, the first dedicating act that took place within the Beis HaMikdash, significantly, is with Yaakov pouring this oil on the stone. That's Maisa Avos for what's to come in terms of the setting up of the Beis HaMikdash. Says Meshe Chochma, once we understand that this act of pouring the oil on the stone by Yitzhak Shemana Rosha is Maase Avos for the Beis HaMikdash, we can understand why Yaakov didn't do this initially, but only when he woke up the next morning. And to preface, so that we can appreciate exactly where his explanation is coming from, what is the concept, what is the meaning of Maase Avos Siman Labanim? It seems to be just a nice way of previewing Jewish history. But does it make a difference one way or the other? Whatever happens to the descendants has already happened to the fathers. Does it make a difference that it's already happened to the fathers? And if it does, what is that difference? And this the Ramban discusses in Parshas Lech Lecha. And he explains that in fact the difference is decisive. Because we're familiar with the concept and it relates to numerous areas. And the concept is that that sometimes when a spiritual happening needs to come into the world, it's harnessed and activated and enlisted through some trigger act, some physical act. That's what brings, in a sense, the latent energy which allows it to express itself later on. Where do we see this? Many nevuahs, for example, are accompanied by acts, by descriptive acts. And what they're doing is they basically act out what the nevuah is going to be. With the Nevi'im, Yechezkel should be in his left side and then his right side, and he should throw a rock into the water, and that's how Bavel will sink, and so on and so forth. What's behind these acts? It's not merely to make an impression on those who are there, but rather that act is the catalyst. It's the trigger act that will then enable the ruchnius energy that will actually become the prophecy to come into the world. It's the interface almost between which gives it entry. And the same is true for many of the makos we find. Moshe was told, raise up your staff, throw up the ashes, hit the Nile, whoever hit the Nile. Those do not naturally have the effect of the plague, but supernaturally they do, and they are the act that enlists that energy. Well, if every miracle needs a trigger act, then as we quote very often from Rabbi Yaakov Emden, there is no greater miracle than the Jewish people themselves, the survival of the Jewish people, and their success against all manner of adversity and persecution, and worse. So what are the trigger acts that allow for that miracle, called the history of the Jewish people? The answer is Maase Avos. Those are the enabling acts, which means that the expression, which is well known, Maase Avos Siman Labanim, is perhaps less than accurate. One could say it doesn't do justice to this concept, because a siman is a sign. But when you give a sign for something, you're not actually enabling it to happen. You're just informing a person as to what might happen, or pointing them to the way of something. But these acts are not just signs. They're not just informative. They're formative. They actually set about and enable those things to happen. Achar hadvarim ha'ele. With this understanding of Maase Avos, we can appreciate what the Meshech Chachma is about to say. And he does so over the course of 1.5 lines. Everything we've said is really background to appreciate exactly what he's going to say. But it turns out that if we see, again, this act of Yaakov pouring the oil on this matzeva as the Maisa Avos, or a Maisa Avos act for the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and we appreciate that these acts are not just symbolic and they're not just informational, but they are the beginning of the process. Well then, says Meshech Chachma, do we not know from the Gemara in Maseches Shavuos that the building of the Beis HaMikdash has to take place during the day? Ein binyan Beis HaMikdash balayla. B'yom hakim is HaMishkan. U'v'yom hakim, says the Gemara, it's got to happen during the day. Says Meshech Chachma, if it's one of the bylaws and stipulations of the halachas of building the Beis HaMikdash that it can only happen during the day, we need to appreciate that Yaakov's act of pouring the oil on the matzeva as Maisa Avos was the first act of building, and as such, it has to take place during the day. That's why he didn't do it when he woke up in the middle of the night, but waited until the morning. So we see how the worlds of Parshanut and Machshava and the Halacha come together, as they so often do in these comments of Meshech Chachma. Okay, Yaakov moves on, and he comes to Lavan's house. And let us take a look at that meeting. He gets a good reception from Lavan, actually. In Perek Kaftes Pasuk Yud Gimel. Perek Kaftes Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayehi kishmo Lavan Hashem Yaakov ben Achoso. So Rochel has come and told Lavan there's a new cousin in town. When he hears about Yaakov by Yoretz Likroso, he runs to him, vayichabeklo, vayinasheklo. He hugs him and he kisses him. Vayevieh Abaser brings him into his house. It's a very good reception. Vayisaper leLavan is called Varma Eile. And then Yaakov tells him everything that happened. And then in Pasuk Yudalad, we have an interesting statement on the part of Lavan. Pasuk Yudalad reads, Vayomer lo Lavan. So Lavan says to Yaakov, Ach, Atzmi uvesari ata. Ach, only? Atzmi uvesari, my bone, my flesh. Atzmi uvesari ata. As the Vilna Gaon famously says, based on the Mishnah, the father is considered to. What's the difference between atzmi and vesari? I mean, they're both part of a person's makeup. So if you're related, presumably, either one will do. But the Mishnah says that it's the father that's considered to supply the bones, and the mother that supplies the flesh. So therefore, when you talk about atzmi, you're talking about someone who's related paternally. When you talk about besari, it's someone who's related maternally. Yaakov and Lavan are so intertwined family-wise that actually they're related both to the father and the mother through with all the Terach and Haran and Nachor, etc. And therefore, atzmi u'besari. You're related to me both ways. Stay with me. But what is the meaning of the word ach? We know that ach has a kind of a limiting connotation. In the words of the Yerushalmi, achim verakim miyutim hem. The term ach and rak, they come to diminish or to exclude. What's being excluded here? He's saying to Yaakov, you're my family. What's being excluded? Says the Netziv, and this is now Lavan true to form. Lavan has heard Yaakov's story, and Yaakov's story is very interesting because Lavan is now finding out about, catching up on a lot of history about his two nephews. And they're quite different from each other, it's safe to say. And what comes out from the story is Yaakov has been persecuted by Esav. Esav is up to no good. So what's interesting is, here's Lavan, and you could say that Lavan is being put in a conflicting position, because it's hard for him to take the side of one without opposing the other. And he is the uncle of both of them. And this is aside from the Gemara in Baba Basra, the well-known Gemara, which says that children often take after the mother's brother. So in other words, he's looking at these two nephews and they're so different from each other. So how can he explain himself to Yaakov that he wants to take Yaakov in? But he does so in pure love and style. And basically he says, Ach, atzmi uvesori, you know, I see you really, you and me, one of a kind. Ach, to the exclusion of that no goodnik, Esav, I don't know where he came from. I would never want to be considered to be his uncle. So in other words, at this point, he's dividing between the two. Ach, atzmi, only you are related to me. Either I would never admit to being related to Esav. And that's how he curries favor with Yaakov. That's a classic love on line. But Rashi, as we know, says something else. Rashi says, Ach, atzmi, uvesori. And again, Rashi clearly is addressing the same issue. Ach, is comes to limit. But what does that mean? See, Yaakov told them the whole story, that he's basically destitute, he came with nothing. This is the Eliphaz story, where he left with a lot, but then Eliphaz caught up with him on his father's instructions to kill him. And Yaakov managed to convince him that it would be not appropriate to kill him, but his father told him to. Yaakov parts with all his things, a person who's poor, is like he's dead, oni choshev kemes, and they part ways. So Yaakov comes with nothing. So what does Lavan say in Pasuk Yudal? Ach atzmi uvesori. Me'ata, if you have nothing, so eini la'asbecha habaisa, so I shouldn't really take you in now, because you don't have anything. Ho v'ein b'yadcha klum. So what should I do? Ela mipnei kurva atapa b'chachu d'shamim. But you are related to me. And that's basically the only thing I can say in your favor, is that you're related to me. You have nothing else to show for yourself. So I'll take you in for a month. That's how Rashi explains. Ach atzmi v'sari. What's being diminished? The only thing I can say about you is that you're related to me. Ach, nothing else? You have no assets, you have no anything. That's how Rashi explains. Which is a little blunt as a welcome. It's quite different than the way that Siv explains, but also the way that one understands love and normally operates. He's a little bit more guileish than that. And just to tell a person to his face, you've got nothing going for you. I mean, it doesn't sound the kind of the conniving way that Lavan would speak. It sounds like a little bit too gauche for what we'd expect from Lavan, if we're entitled to expect anything from Lavan. And there is a fascinating explanation of this Rashi, which is found in the Ksav Sofer. And how does it begin? It begins with the fact that and here we are, when Rashi has already explained that when Lavan sees Yaakov, he runs towards him. Why does he run towards him? Kesavar, says Rashi, Mamon hu ta'un. So Lavan ran towards him. And by the way, this is the second time Lavan ran towards someone and got his expectations dashed a little bit too quickly, because no one ever turned out to have anything for him. But he thought that he's got to have money. Shari Evan Habayis Balakan Basar Gamalim Tuunim. The help came, Eliezer, and he had 10 camels worth. And here's the master himself, young master Yaakov. I'm pretty sure he's good. But then he didn't see anything. So then what? So then he hugs him. Why is he hugging him? Rashi says, Kishelo ra imo klum. He didn't see anything with Yaakov. He thought, oh, Shema Zehuvim Hevi. It's got to be that he's keeping all of his valuables on his person. So he hugs him and he pats him down for valuables, credit cards, whatever it might be, and nothing. So this is very disappointing, but that was the last thing he did. But Yanashiklo, so he kisses him. He gives him like very firm kisses on the cheek. He's checking his teeth. Right, Shema Margolius heavy. Maybe he's got jewels in his mouth. I mean, and then it's really, in the end, it's really nothing. Interestingly, these are very negative motivations that are ascribed to Lavan. Perhaps one of the reasons why is because the verb used when he kisses Yaakov is vayinashik, which is quite intense. There's two ways that the kiss is described in the Torah, vayinashik or vayishak. And when it comes to relatives and derech eretz and protocol and saying hello, so it's normally vayishak. In other words, that's enough. That's the standard for an uncle, for whatever. That's the way people kiss their uncle, so that's vayishak. Rarely do we find vayinashik. If you want to see a vayinashik in action, you look for example in Parshas Vayigash, when Yosef is reunited with the brothers after 22 years of all that they went through. Okay, vayinashik lecha lecha b'keir, we can understand. That was a very intense reuniting. Here, Lava never met him before. All of a sudden, vayinashik. And I think that's why Rashi sees that there's a little bit more to this than just being nice as an uncle sort of thing. He's right, he's checking. Where's the jewelry? Where's the goods? And in the end, it's nothing. And then Yaakov comes in, and that's why Laban says to him, "You don't have anything. All you have going for you is that you're my nephew." And that'll have to do for now. That's the lead out there. But what is happening here? Interestingly, if we go back to Yaakov's meeting with Rachel, so it says. In Pasuk Yud Beis, Perikav Tes Pasuk Yud Beis. Vayaged Yaakov l'Rachel, so Yaakov tells Rachel, Ki achi aviyahu, he's her father's brother. V'chi ben Rivkahu, and he's Rivka's son. Vataratz vatageid l'aviyah, and she went and told her father. Now, seemingly, there's a redundancy here. It says that he's her father's brother, and he's Rivka's son. He's only her father's brother to the extent that he is Rivka's son. I mean, that's another way of saying the same thing. Why is he her father's brother? They're related. How? Because he's Rivka's son. That's not a separate thing. But they're mentioned in the Pasuk as two different things. And that's why the well-known Rashi says that these two phrases, her father's brother and Rivka's son, are two different ways of acting, two different modes. And it's based on the Gemara in Bava Basra. He says, I don't know how Lavan's going to act with me. I've heard things, I don't know. Maybe he wants to be tricky with me. Maybe he wants to be cunning with me. If that's the case, I'm his brother. I could be cunning as well. Achiv Baramos, I'm his brother, cunning. Now, maybe he want to be honest with me. I can for sure be honest. I'm Rivka's son. So however he wants to play it, that's what Yaakov is saying. It's a very interesting perush. Achi Avia and Ben Rivka, two different ways. I'm ready for anything. You should know I'm ready for anything. So there's a couple of questions here, quite different types of questions. Firstly, is that really true? In other words, Achi Baramos, He really is as cunning as Lavan. He doesn't seem to be, and secondly, good. He shouldn't be as cunning as Lavan. Only people like Lavan are as cunning as Lavan. It's not a good thing to be. But he says he is, but we don't really find that he is as cunning as Lavan. And as tragic as it is, we're kind of relieved. We don't want him to be as cunning as Lavan. But what's also very interesting is how the pasuk concludes. Vataratz vatageid l'aviyah. She ran and told Lavan. Presumably, what she told Lavan is what Yaakov told her. And what he told her is that I'm as cunning as your father. Which, if you really are at all cunning, is the last thing you want to tell him. Because there goes that. The Klal Gadol about cunning people is they don't advertise themselves as cunning people. Which basically, it's an amateurish thing to do. It's not cunning at all. Most people who announce the fact that they're cunning end up getting duped very quickly. So it's interesting. According to Rashi, he's saying I'm as cunning as him, and Rachel says, "Okay, so I'll go and tell him." But you don't want to tell him, and that's why the Ksav Sofer says that Yaakov is not as cunning as Lavan. That's and good. But something else is happening here. Because Yaakov knows Lavan. He knows that Lavan will be nice to him if he has money. And for that reason, he took money when he came. But he's had to part with it, for Eliphaz reasons, as we saw. So now he has nothing. And basically, his prospects of being allowed into Lavan's house with nothing are nil. But he needs to be there. He's been sent there. But how do you get an entry into Laban's house if you don't have anything? There's only one way, says Yaakov. He leaks a message to Laban. He tells Rachel, I'm telling you, if your father's cunning, I'm equally as cunning as him. You should know that about me. And she goes and tells Laban. So Laban has heard that Yaakov is a cunning person. And now it can begin. Why? Because Laban already has information on Yaakov that Yaakov is his equal in cunning. And now begins a bit of a game. Whereby, so he runs to meet Yaakov, expecting a fortune. He doesn't see a fortune. Says Laban, okay, round one to Yaakov. I know he's a cunning person. There's no way that he doesn't have money with him. He's not going to carry it on him. And you know what? I respect that. Cunning people respect other cunning people. There's a fortune. It's got to be somewhere. But he's not showing his hand. Good for him. That's good. But it's got to be somewhere. And therefore he starts to hug him. He's looking because maybe it's concealed. He doesn't find anything. And then Laban says, okay, Yaakov is really good. I mean, he does not carry anything on his person. One last thing he tries. He kisses him. Vayinashek, jewels in the mouth, nothing. He says, Laban, this person is an expert. I mean, I rarely do you see such talent. He shows up with nothing. Clearly he's got a fortune. I don't know where it is. But one thing's for sure. I'm going to find out. He's coming with me. I'm not going to let him out of his sight. And thus did Yaakov gain entry into Laban's house with nothing, because he'd given Laban to understand that he's cunning, and Laban thinks he has everything, but he really didn't have anything. And that's why Laban says he makes almost like a show of disdain for Yaakov, saying, oh, well, if you have no money, then I shouldn't really even take you in. Why would he talk that way? Because he's trying to cover up the fact that he knows that Yaakov is full of money. Whereas in reality, he didn't have anything. And so, on this one occasion, Yaakov didn't really need to do anything that was cunning. He just needed to let the message out. And thus did he gain entry into Laban's house. And of course, from there, things progress as the Parsha continues to describe. But a really fabulous explanation of the Rashis here from the Ksav Sofer, certainly food for thought. We'll leave it over there for this.